So we're going to get started now. So if everyone could take their seats and end their side conversations, that'd be appreciated. Welcome. Thank you, everybody. This is the session for community priority evaluation and new GTLD auctions. So if you're not here for this, ask you to step outside, please.
Could we have your attention, please? Excuse us. Thank you.
So I'm Russ Weinstein. I'm senior manager on the GTLD program. And like I said, community priority evaluations and new GTLD auctions are the topic for today. I have Larry Ozabel from Power Auctions, our auctions provider, here with me, and Steve Chan, a manager of new GTLD operations as well. Next. So the agenda for today is we'll give you an overview of where we're at so far with contention set resolution. We'll provide a discussion on community priority evaluation, or CPE. And then we'll open for a discussion Q&A portion on CPE for about 10 minutes or so. And then we'll move on to new GTLD auctions. I'll go through the status update, readiness, some process and timeline information, and then turn it over to Larry, who will give you some simulation of the system and more explanation about ascending clock auctions. Then we'll open it back up for discussion topics that we talked about in the webinar a couple, 11 days ago or so, and then open up for general Q&A after that. Next. So current contention resolution status, you'll see the figures on the left represent the initial figures after the string similarity panel performed its evaluation. So we had 234 contention sets with 758 applications placed into contention. Currently we're at about 201 contention sets with 657 applications in contention, and these figures do not account for the string confusion objection determinations yet. We've named Economist Intelligence Unit, or EIU as we call them, as the CPE panel, and they're actively engaged on CPE. And as mentioned earlier, we have Power Auctions LLC as the auction provider. And just always a friendly reminder that auctions are expected to be the method of last resort to resolve string contention. You're always encouraged to resolve string contention amongst yourselves. With that, I'll turn it over to Steve.
Thank you, Russ. So, as Russ just mentioned, CP is underway. It started on the 24th of October. The evaluations are expected to take 2 to 3 months, and perhaps an extra 2 weeks to actually get results published on the CPE microsite. In terms of the evaluation pipeline, we have two that are actually in evaluation, two that are invited, and 28 that remain they still need to become eligible to be invited. For the two that are in evaluation, if there are CQs necessary, we expect them to be sent early to mid-December, and we could see first results as early January 2014. So as those 28 community applications in contention become eligible, they'll be invited on a weekly basis. And we will be updating the CPE microsite regularly with invitations and elections, and you can visit that URL for continued status updates. We often get questions about eligibility, so I just want to remind everyone what the eligibility requirements are for our invitation. The community application itself must be self-designated per section 1.23 of the AGB. They must be in an active string contention set. They must not have a pending change request, and they also must not be in a 30-day application comment window for an approved change request. In addition, all members of the set must also have completed evaluation, have no pending objections, have no unresolved GAC advice, and not be classified as high risk per the name collision occurrence management plan. So next, I just wanted to talk about process, specifically the invitation and notification process. So as I mentioned earlier, we will be inviting eligible applications on a weekly basis. From the date of invitation, they'll receive 21 days to both elect and also pay the $22,000 USD deposit. At the same time that we do the invitation, we'll also notify every other member of the contingent set that they have been invited. And one other thing that we'll also do at the same time is update the CPE microsite to reflect the invitation date. And why that's important is that application comments and correspondence, the due date for receiving those and to be taken into account by the panel, it needs to be received 14 days after the invitation date. I'll get a little closer. In terms of evaluation scope, all elements of the public portion of the application will be reviewed. They'll also be looking at application comments, letters of support, and opposition, and also objection determinations. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the CQ process. One of the main efforts that we're trying to do is have the panel validate letters of support. So validating letters of support is something that the panel will do proactively. They will reach out to the contacts as referenced in the letters of support or opposition. I know there's been a little bit of confusion that the contacts do not need to proactively reach out to the panel. The panel will reach out to the contacts. So in the event that the contact is not responsive, one of the things that we want to address in the CQs is have the panel reach out to the applicant and have them coordinate and have the contact actually hopefully respond. One other thing that's part of the scope for the CQs is that the applicant will have the opportunity to respond in the event that application comment, letters of opposition, or objection determinations materially affect the scoring. So we had a correspondence going back and forth. The correspondence method is not intended to be a way to communicate back and forth between perhaps someone providing comments to the application. If the applicant has a, or if the elements are affecting the scoring, then the applicant will have the opportunity to respond to them. And also, the applicant may be given a chance to clarify application responses, and that's clarify, not expand or change their answers. In regards to time of CQs, they're expected to be roughly 1 month into the evaluation process, and consistent with initial evaluation, applicants will receive 28 days to respond to the CQs. This is a timeline that's also on our CPU microsite. It just gives you a rough overview of the evaluation process. It's consistent with what I was just talking about, the 21 days to elect and pay, the 14-day deadline for application comment and correspondence. It's approximately a month for evaluation, and if clarifying questions are issued and required, then the applicant gets 1 month to respond, and there is an additional month for finalization and publication of results. So all told, it's about 2 to 3 months for evaluation and publication of results. So that's actually my slides. I'm going to turn it over to question and answer.
So if there's any question and answer related to CPE, we'd like to take it at this time. And there's a mic up here for the queue.
Andrew Merriam, Top Level Design. Good afternoon. Real quickly on the issue of clarifying applications, questions in the original application, will that be public, the responses or what's being clarified?
Consistent with initial evaluation, it will not actually be published. It will not be published.
I mean, the original application was published, so it seems that if it's significant change involved, publishing it might be relevant.
So as was indicated in the slide, the CQ process is not intended to allow significant change to the application. Okay. It's supposed to be a clarification, literally a clarification.
Thanks.
Hi, this is Urs Eris from Intellinix, an applicant for new GTLDs, which are in contention sets with some community applications. I have a question concerning the notification and the comments. How is the notification of the other applicants going to take place? Is it going to be a letter? Is it going to be electronic notification?
So the notification to the other applicants in the contention set, they'll be communicated via the customer portal. They'll actually receive a case effectively at the same time that we actually invite the eligible community applicant.
Okay, so it's going to be an electronic?
Electronic.
Okay, here we go. The comment, you said then you have a comment phase where you can comment on the application itself. I guess the comments have to be in electronic form as well. The question is, can anyone comment, or does it have to have a relation to that application? And must the comment include proofs or other material stuff to underline the issue, or is it just enough to do a comment?
So first, just a clarification. It's not necessarily a it's not a window for a comment. It's more of a deadline, because even at this point, you can actually still comment on applications. So it's more of a deadline to give the panel a cutoff date so that they know what to take into account for their evaluation. In terms of who is allowed to comment or submit correspondence, you don't have to have a relation. If you'd like to comment, you can comment. If you want to submit a letter of opposition, you can do that too via correspondence. So it's whoever wants to comment.
Okay, so as far as I got it, the more substantial we comment, in case we would do so, the more the panel is gonna go into the material. Is that right?
So the clarification Russ was just whispering to me, it's their job to determine what is relevant and what needs to be taken account and what might materially affect the score.
Perfect. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Stefan Legner, also from Internetix. My question is, who is the final authority defining that a community evaluation is really valid and it really targets a community, or whether or not?
We selected the Economist Intelligence Unit as the CP panel. It's ultimately their responsibility to evaluate the applicant against the CP criteria that's in the applicant guidebook, and also their supplemental evaluation guidelines. So it's ultimately their responsibility to come up with a determination.
So they will have the legally binding final decision whether it's a community application or not.
I understand. So the panel provides a recommendation to ICANN,
okay,
similar to initial evaluation or any of the evaluation panels, and then ICANN will
so they will. So they make a presentation to ICANN, and ICANN will decide.
Yes, they will present their results to ICANN and their rationale, and provide ICANN with confidence that they performed the evaluation per the guidelines and the AGB, and that they've done their job. And then ICANN will, if we believe that the job was done with the proper due diligence and to the requirements, then we will publish the results.
Okay, so there will... You will be, or the evaluator will be the one having the final decision.
As I stated earlier.
Okay.
This is Dan Halloran from ICANN Legal. Just wanted to, Russ, you're doing great answering the questions, but just want to remind everyone that Russ is trying to give out general information and respond to questions. You're asking about legally binding final answers. Like, go read the applicant guidebook. That's what's final and binding. And we try to take care when we put out, like, written information and webinars or advisories that's final and legal and binding. Or even there, we sometimes give caveats, like, we're trying to give out general information here, and please refer to the applicant guidebook. So I just want... You feel like it's open season to kind of cross-examine Russ here and drill down. And if you have specific detailed questions like that, I encourage you to put it through the customer service portal. And we can, you know, then Russ can go to his attorneys. We can look carefully at the guidebook and give a carefully crafted answer. Just want to put that caveat and help Russ out that he's trying to give you information here, but don't, like, pull out, you know, some word that he said and said, oh, look, here on this date in Buenos Aires, Russ said this, and this is binding. This is a general information session, and just wanted to give you that general piece of information. Thanks.
Hi, I'm Salanieta Tamanikawemaro, and I'm on the ALAC, but the views that I'm going to give, or the question, is actually my own question. I'm not speaking for the ALAC. First of all, we had submitted contributions when you were developing the CPE guidelines. Very pleased with your presentation. Thank you. It brings a lot of clarity. However, I do have a question, particularly with respect to what you mentioned in terms of the final, if there were to be a final contention or dispute, it would be resolved by way of auction. And so by virtue of looking at the timeline, I pay particular reference to instances where the constituency that may be affected, when I say constituency or use that word in my framing my question, I'm not referring to a constituency within ICANN, but a constituency or a community outside of ICANN that could possibly be affected. So herein lies my question. A, would the context of a notice be from the perspective of the publication on the ICANN website, and I know that there are other processes involved where you're getting validations from supposed communities, but in the event or in the foreseeable event where there were underserved communities that may not necessarily be on the radar but possibly affected, but who do not have the capacity to engage in the auction, and I know it's probably not within the remit of the CPE panel, but certainly it would be within your remit in terms of scoring. So I'm very, very interested, and we don't have to discuss it now, but if you can relay me to maybe a website or a link or where someplace I can go to where I can ask further questions in relation to this, because this is something that the at-large community is very concerned about, particularly in relation to those timelines. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think might be mixing a couple things together. Only new GTLD applicants who are in the contention set will participate in an auction for that contention set. So the affected communities will not be participating in the auction should it go to an auction. Maybe I can point you to Module 4 of the Applicant Guidebook and also to the CPE and auctions pages within the new GTLD microsite that might be of value to you.
Hi, this is a question from the remote participant. I'm not sure if it's already been answered, but the question is, what is the mechanism, if any, for reviewing or challenging a specific EIU recommendation?
Thanks, Wendy. This is Christine Ouellette. I'll take that question. So as with any determination as part of ICANN, not just applicants, but others in the community have multiple mechanisms to pursue. They have the ombudsman for issues of fairness, they have reconsideration requests, and they have the IRP. So all of those mechanisms are in place for panel and new GTLD evaluation work as with any other aspect of ICANN. Thank you.
This is Yanis from Dakis Foundation. I would like to ask about what if we have like additional support letter from the community? Is still that the case that we can further support it in the customer service portal, or how will it be done? Like, also, what is the time frame for like further support? Further adding the support letter. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. So there's two mechanisms available to you at this point. One is to submit the additional letters as correspondence. That will that result in the letters being published on the correspondence page, of course. It'll also allow you to avoid having your invitation, if you end up being eligible, delayed by the 30-day comment period. So the other method that you can add additional letter support is via change request. So our recommended method for you, though, is to submit via correspondence.
So does it mean that the community members can actually use the application comment for to add their like support letter there as well?
So the application comment mechanism doesn't actually allow attachments. So if it's actually a letter that's signed and has a contact in there that you want attached as a letter, you'd have to either use one of the two mechanisms I mentioned, either correspondence or a change request. In the FAQs on the CP microsite, it also has an explanation for that process.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Great. And then just to jump back to one of the earlier questions about publishing the CQs and the CQ responses, we're going to look into that and see what mechanisms we have available. Seems like something we should consider. So thanks for pointing that out. Last CPE question here.
Oh, hi, Ray Fassett. A question I have is, what is the email address for the correspondence?
It's the standard newgtld@icann.org, the customer service email address.
Great, thanks. And then a second question is, on the panelists, is it going to be the same panelists that review all of the community evaluations, or will there be different panelist members? And is it one panelist or three panelists? If you can provide a little background on that.
So in terms of panels, there's only a single panel. It's going to be the EIU. In terms of panelists, the expectation is that they will do parallel reviews, so there'll be two evaluation panelists evaluating the application in parallel. I haven't actually asked them. Christine's walking up. I'll let her respond.
So the EIU will be assigning experts with history and background in the specific communities that are relevant. So they will have expertise in the areas that they are evaluating. So there will be multiple panels.
And whether it'll be a single expert panelist or multiple panelists?
Yes, it's not an individual. It is multiple individuals participating in the evaluation, in each evaluation.
All right, so one last unfair question, and you don't have to answer. Does it require if there's more than one panelist, it could be, say, if there's three, it could be a 2-to-1 decision, and that'll be published?
So the panel presents one single combined result to ICANN. We've had a financial panel, a technical panel. Each panel provides a single result to ICANN. It's not that they have three votes. We get a single result that is published to us.
Great. That's very helpful. Thanks. So it's different than the objection process.
Yes. It follows the very similar to the other evaluation panel processes. I know we've been talking a lot about objections and expert panelists in terms of objections. It is dissimilar to that, and it is much more similar, and it is an evaluation panel, just as our other evaluation panels have been. In fact, the EIU did also, they were one of our panel firms doing the geographic names evaluation. So they're familiar with the program. This is not a new concept to them.
Yeah,
Thank you.
That's very helpful. And then different, though, than the other evaluation process, there will be a report published, and the scoring will be, and the rationale for the scoring will be made public for people to review, the rationale of the scoring?
Yeah. Yes. So I believe at the last webinar on this, the team mentioned that yes, since it is a standalone evaluation, we will have an individual CPE report published, and it will have the scoring included and the explanation of that score. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Werner Staub, Evercore Core. My question is about accountability. Now, accountability is one of the basic ICANN principles. And for some strange reason, which has always complained about, it was not part of the community evaluation criteria in the guidebook. But let's say it is possible to argue that it is implicitly part of it. You know, you cannot say accountability would not be important in an ICANN context. And you could say that accountability is, of course, part of criteria like community delineation. It is part of organization. It is part of detriment. You know, basically, at some point, you know, someone needs to be accountable. But my question, however, is whether the discussion that is going to be published by the panel is going to discuss the matter. I think that is important because specifically in the one the related thing that I've been involved in, which is the .sport objection, which has prevailed, actually accountability was discussed by the panelists. So I think that is important that it be discussed. Now, is there any expectation that we could have that accountability, specifically for the affected parties, would be discussed in the context of the community priority? When I say affected parties, I don't mean the applicants or the GTLD operators, but the parties who are affected by the use of the TLD in the end users, web users.
So if you're not talking about the applicant being accountable, who are you talking about being accountable?
I think somebody to be accountable. Somebody to be accountable. Because that's what the internet community expects. And to say to the internet community, oh, no problem, ICANN was accountable when it handed the thing over to an unaccountable party, but from there on, no, never mind, we have a problem.
So as I mentioned previously, we have three accountability mechanisms as per our bylaws. We have the ombudsman, we have the reconsideration request, and we have the IRP. So we will adhere to all of those accountability mechanisms. And we are continuing CPE, community priority evaluation, is proceeding as per the guidebook, as per the criteria in the guidebook. And we have outsourced it to a competent, reviewed expert panel, as we have much of the evaluations, with the exception of a single applicant support panel, all of the rest of the evaluation work has been outsourced to expert third parties. So thank you for your feedback. I appreciate the comments.
I just wanted to make the difference between accountability of ICANN to people who deal with ICANN directly, as opposed to accountability of users of the internet who expect to have some accountability about people controlling resources that affect them. And somehow ICANN should be careful about whom it hands those resources to. Users expect accountability, not specifically the one that we have in the guidebook.
Thank you.
Question from a remote participant, Eric Brunner-Williams. Will the qualifications and membership of a particular panel making a particular determination be made public along with the recommendation?
So the panel making the perform the CPE process has already been named the Economist Intelligence Unit. They went through a RFI process for selection, and we have been already shared that information publicly.
Sorry, I'm going to cut you off. We need to move on to the auctions portion.
Pardon me?
We need to move on to the auctions portion
of
the
presentation. One last clarifying question. Just 10 seconds.
I didn't really get the answer before.
Like, who is finally drawing the decision? Is it the panel giving a suggestion to the board, and the board says yes, or is the panel doing the final decision?
So the panel makes a recommendation and provides a report to ICANN.
Here we go.
So, yeah, we've already, Russ has answered that. Thank you.
Excellent. All right, so now we're going to get back to new GTLD auctions. So I'm going to talk through readiness status, process and timeline, and then I'll hand it over to Larry to talk through the explanation of an ascending clock auction in a little bit more visual fashion than I was able to in the last webinar, and as well as a screenshot demonstration of the auction system that we'll be using, and then I'll bring it back to the topics of discussion that I presented at the last webinar. So as we said, Power Auctions is the auction manager, and they're helping us with auction design, a customized software solution to execute the auctions, and overall auctions operations management. On November 1st, we published the preliminary auction rules, so you can find those on the microsite. And on November 7th, we held a webinar focused on auctions, so much of the content in my presentation will come from that, but hoping for more discussion at the end. We plan to publish the bidder agreement in mid-December. That's our current target, and we're tracking well to that. We believe early 2014, we can begin notifying applicants of intent to auction, and with the first auction events being held in early March, in the March timeframe of 2014. And now I'll let Larry introduce Power Auctions.
So, thanks, Russ. We're a specialty provider of auction design, auction software, and auction manager services. We operate in a variety of sectors, including telecommunications spectrum. That is, we auction licenses for cell phone service. We do electricity. We do natural gas. We do diamonds. We've never done new GTLDs before, but we are familiar with doing extremely novel subject matter. So for half a century, the U.S. government has auctioned offshore oil leases. Recently, Power Auctions designed an auction for offshore wind energy tracts, and we conducted the first two auctions this year. Our current notable auctions include the Australian Digital Dividend Auction. This was in April and May of this year. It raised about $2 billion in revenues. We're also going to be we've designed and will be operating the Canadian 700 megahertz spectrum auction early next year. That's of a similar scale. In all, we've done more than 150 high-stakes auctions on our software platform since 2001. I think we're unique among auction providers in that we've conducted auctions for clients and with bidders on six continents. We filled that out recently this year when we started doing diamond auctions in Botswana. Our auctions are implemented as a web application. We meet government and other standards for stability and security. Our auctions are replicated to a geographically separate server, and so our reliability is extremely high. Maybe the takeaway I should leave you with more than anything is we've done this before. And so if you have any concerns about the auctions getting started or going on interminably, that should not be your concern. And we'll be giving you further explanation of details.
Thanks, Larry. So now I'll talk through process and timeline of the auction program. Next one. So eligibility, eligibility criteria for an auction is very similar to CPE. Each active application in a contention set must have passed evaluation, resolved any applicable GAC advice, have no pending objections, and no pending change requests. And then each applied for GTLD in the contention set must not be classified as high risk per the name collision occurrence management plan, and must be eligible for the alternate path to delegation or have received their SLD collision occurrence assessment from ICANN. If you don't know what I'm talking about, maybe you can listen to the previous session, and we'll publish some announcements recently on those topics. Next. So process-wise, the auction process starts with ICANN performing these eligibility assessments of contention sets. Then we, once we determine eligibility, there's a notification of intent to auction that goes to each member of the contention set, and that goes via the customer portal. We consider these qualified applicants. So the qualified applicant will have the ability to name its designated bidder and provide materials related to performing due diligence on that bidder from a standpoint of receiving fund transactions. The designated bidder is an entity. We've defined it in the auction rules, but it's the entity that owns the bank account that will supply the funds and will be the source account. So it can be an entity other than the entity that is the applicant. The bidder and the applicant will be required to execute the bidder agreement, and these items are due within 30 days of after notification of intent to auction. And they'll be returned back to ICANN via the customer portal. ICANN will then review the materials and begin setting up with Power Auctions their auction accounts and escrow accounts. And then after a period of about 2 weeks, we'll be able to set an auction date with what participants are participating in each auction event. So this auction, we will notify the applicants of their auction date and provide credential information to transition from the ICANN system to the Power Auction systems. Next. Leading up to the auction, as I said, we'll transition you from the ICANN systems to Power Auction systems, where they'll provide wire instructions for submitting the deposit. You'll provide information as to where the funds will be directed back in the event that you do not win the auction. And you'll be able to designate two authorized individuals from the bidder to participate in the auction itself. Once the deposit deadline occurs, which is 7 days prior to the auction, this begins what we're calling a blackout period. During this blackout period, discussions among contending applicants must cease, and their designated bidders must cease, and withdrawals will not be processed during this blackout period. Uh, All right. Thanks. A mock auction will be conducted by Power Auctions the day before the auction event, and this is for the designated bidders, authorized individuals of that particular auction event that we're holding. And this will give them a chance to kind of practice in the system and see what it's like to participate in an ascending clock auction. Next. So putting this process into a timeline, you'll see notifications go out on what we'll call day zero or day one. The bidder forms are due back to ICANN within 30 days, once the first triangle. This is also the deadline to request postponement of an auction, and I have more information on that at the end. The auction will be scheduled approximately, a schedule notification will go out approximately 2 to 3 weeks later, and the applicant will be transitioned over to the Power Auctions team. 7 days before the auction event, the bidding deposit is due. 1 day before the auction event, the mock auction occurs. The auction event will occur on a Wednesday, and non-winning deposits will be refunded. The transaction will be initiated within 7 days after the auction, and winners' payments are due within 20 days after the auction. And one more bit about bidding deposits and bidding limits. I think I've mentioned 7 days prior to the auction. Deposits cannot be modified after the deposit deadline. They'll be held in an escrow account at a major U.S. commercial bank. We're still working to finalize that agreement before we can name the entity, but we believe we'll have that very soon. And deposits must be sent to the escrow provider by wire and denominated in U.S. dollars. The bidding deposit will determine your maximum bidding limit, and Larry will explain a little bit more about how that's going to work. But each application will have its own deposit and bidding limit. The bidding limit for an auction is set at 10 times the amount of your deposit, and a $2 million deposit will provide unlimited bidding limit for that application. So now I'll turn it over to Larry to talk you through what an ascending clock auction is all about.
So I'm also an economics professor, as will probably become obvious from this slide, but pay attention now, because basically the whole procedure of the ascending clock auction is going to be shown in this slide. So this is just an example of a contention set with five bidders. And at each round of the auction manager will announce a price range, which will be a start of round price and an end of round price. So the start of round price in the first round, as is shown here, is $1. The end of round price will be announced, and then the round starts. Okay, so what's shown here, during the round, each bidder will indicate whether they're in all the way to the end of round price or whether they've reached their bidding limit. So here, what you have are five bidders. They all continued to the end of round price for round one, and it'll be announced after round one to all those bidders that there are still five in. Okay, then we go on to round two. A price range is announced for round two, and bidders will submit bids for round two, again indicating whether they're in through the end of round price or whether they've reached their max. Okay, so here's an example of bidding that might occur during round two. What we see are that bidder A reached its max at about the midpoint between the start of round price and end of round price for round two, while the other four bidders stayed in. So at the end of round two, we still have four bidders in the auction, and that again is announced to all the bidders. Then we go on to round three. A A price range is announced for round three. The round starts, bids come in. So what we have here is that two bidders hit their limit in this example. So what you see in front of you is that bidder B dropped out very near the starting price for round three. Meanwhile, bidder C dropped out near the end of round price for round three, and what we have at the end of round three is two bidders. And after round three is over, that fact is announced to bidders, and we move on to round four. The auction manager announces the price range, the round starts, and the bids come in. And so what you see here is that bidder D dropped out a little bit above the midway point between the start of round price and the end of round price. Meanwhile, the bidder E stayed in until the end of round price. So at the end of round four, we only have one bidder remaining. They're the winner. Now, the remaining thing to say is that the principle of this auction is that it's a second price auction. So the price that will actually be paid by the winner is not how high they were willing to go, but the price at which the next to last remaining bidder dropped out. So you can see on this slide that bidder E wins the auction and pays the price at which bidder D dropped out. Okay. This one got slightly messed up on the screen in front of you, but broadly speaking, there are only two types of bids. Bidding is really easy in an ascending clock auction because the only bids really are, first, continue bids. That means you want to bid all the way to the end of round price of the round, and that guarantees you'll move on to the next round without getting eliminated. And then the second type is an exit bid, and that means that you've reached your maximum during the current round, and then you indicate the maximum, and that means you'll stay all in all the way to that price. But if anyone else has bid higher, then you'll be eliminated. Now, implicit in the whole thing, there's also a third type of bid, but it's really just a special case of a continue bid. So the third type of bid is a proxy bid, and all we mean by a proxy bid is you can enter any price you want as your continue bid. So you could bid, for example, you could bid a round ahead, or you could put your final price in all the way at the beginning of the auction. And that will stay in the system as long as you leave it there. You'll be free to modify it until it's up to the point where it's taken effect. And the last thing to say is that all three of these types of bids may become winning bids. A continue bid becomes a winning bid if you're the last continue bid. Even if you're an exit bid, you may still win, because if every remaining bidder exits this round, then the highest exit bid wins and pays the amount of the second highest exit bid. And then, of course, a proxy bid could win, but it might not win until a few rounds later. Now, in terms of the process, the other thing to indicate is the timeline. So before the start of the auction, the end of round price for round one is announced. Okay, then round one begins. When round one begins, and the preliminary thinking is that round one will be 30 minutes in length, bidders submit their bids anytime during that round, and then finally the round closes. At that point, there will be a recess, where the preliminary thinking is the recess will be 10 minutes. In the recess, first of all, the results of the round will be posted, and then second of all, the prices for the next round will be announced. Now, one important thing to note about this whole design is that there are no incentives created to bid either early or late in the round. Because as you see in this picture, your opponents will not find out anything about your bid until after the round is over. So it doesn't matter whether you placed your bid in the first minute of round one or in the last minute of round one. It won't become known to anybody and it won't take effect until after round one. Okay, so then we go on and have round two. The preliminary thinking is that round two and all subsequent rounds will last 10 minutes. Again, bidders can submit their bids anytime during that round. I should add, they can also revise their bids anytime during that round. The protocol is that whatever bid is in the system when the round ends is the bid that's binding on you. And then after the round closes, the process repeats, the results will get posted, prices will get announced, and we go as many more rounds as is necessary. Okay, the next two slides are really easy ones, this one in particular. The system requirements are not the least bit exotic. What you need is a standard PC or Mac with reliable connectivity, and the browsers that we'll certify will be the newest version of IE, Chrome, and Firefox. We would strongly recommend that a bidder has redundant connectivity. So, for example, they might have a tablet with cellular data access, or they might have a laptop with a 3G card. You could also use as your backup a smartphone. I'd suggest trying it during the mock auction if you're going to do that to make sure your vision's good enough and your manual dexterity is good enough. But in principle, it'll work on a smartphone too. And then finally, the bidder can have its second authorized individual in a separate location as a matter of redundancy as well. And then the guidebook provides, and we will be implementing, having a backup bid facility where you can submit bids by fax. The last thing to say about this is actually your best form of redundant connectivity is simply to make use of the proxy bidding facility. Because, for example, if you always bid one round in advance, then if your internet connection goes down, the bid's already in. And as I say, when you get to the next round, assuming you haven't lost your internet connection, you can edit that bid anyway. As far as bidder training, we take this very seriously for all our auctions. There will be a mock auction prior to each live auction. Participation is optional, but we strongly recommend it for new bidders. The mock auction isn't really a system test, it's a training exercise. It'll generally be one day prior to each live auction. At the very beginning of the process, we might have additional mock auctions in order to accommodate there'll be greater training needs because everyone will be a new bidder. There will also be a user manual published. There'll be a message system within the auction software that will be part of the demo that I get to next. And there will be telephone support during mock auctions and live auctions. Okay, so what we're going to get to now is the system demo. So we're going to begin with bidding in round one. So the first thing that we see is a login screen. It's very standard with HTTPS and all that. After you log in, is that not working? Okay, after you log in, the first screen that you'll see is the screen which gives the information about the strings that you're bidding on. So what's shown here as an example is a bidder who has applications in four separate contention sets in the auction. Go to the next screen. We also, what they'll also see immediately is an auction schedule. So this is just showing a sample schedule where the first round is 30 minutes, all subsequent recesses and rounds are 10 minutes. And then let's go to the bidding screen. So the auction has started. What you see in front of you is the bidding screen that will access all the strings in all the contention sets that you have active right now. What we're going to demonstrate first is the easiest way of bidding. Okay, so suppose you want to continue on all of these strings, then what you can simply do is move the cursor to the highlighted number, which is the end of round price, and you click on it. If you can. And when you click on it, the continue bid is registered, and you've seen that it moved from red to green because you are now guaranteed not to be eliminated for that string this round. So this bidder might also want to continue on the second string, on the third string, and on the fourth string. After doing this, the bidder can then go to the bid confirmation screen that's shown here, and we strongly recommend you print it out. But just to repeat the protocol, what if you look at the bid confirmation screen and you say, oh my God, I placed the wrong bid? Well, if the round's still open, you can actually go back and change your bids, because the bids don't become irrevocable until after the round is over. Okay, after the round is over, we'll go to the next screen. You see a My Results screen, and what that tells you is whether you're still bidding, whether you've won, how many bidders are still in on the licenses, on the applications that you're bidding on. Okay, so let's keep going. In round two, we'll show a second way that you can bid. So let's go to the bidding screen. Now, it might well be that the first string the bidder still wants to click on the end of round price because the bidder wants to continue. But we haven't said what the bidder should do if the bidder wants to exit. So if the bidder wants to exit, well, first of all, if you just look at the extreme right-hand end of the screen, what you see is what's displayed right now, say for the second application, is the highest number they've put in to date. I mean, the standing amount that they've bid. Now, what they could do is click on Edit Bid, and that will populate that same number into a text box, and the bidder can then adjust the number in the text box. Now, oops, the bidder here, there's a problem, and that is this bidder put a $100,000 deposit in for the application, which would establish a bidding limit of $1 million, and the bidder typed in slightly more. So, you know, this, like any good auction system, does edit checks on all your bids. The bid is rejected, but then you can go back into the text box and fix it up. Okay, now we have a bid that's under the limit, and now you could save that bid as well. Okay, and as you see, now it shows, it didn't change from red to green because that's an exit bid. That could still win, but if somebody else bids higher, then you're going to get irrevocably eliminated from the auction. But in any case, the bidder can now go to the third, do the same thing, and maybe, yeah, as shown here, they've entered a 985,000 bid. And then, don't go any further. Just notice that on the fourth, application here, the bidder not only did a continue bid, but the bidder put a proxy bid in. I mean, perhaps this bidder considered $1,138,000 to be the limit. And that one did change from red to green because it's at least the end of round price. The bidder is not going to get eliminated. Okay, after completing this, you would again get a bid confirmation. Again, we recommend you print it out. And then after the round is over, you see a My Results screen for round two. Notice that the second string, where you placed an exit bid, ended up losing, while the third string, where you also put an exit bid in, ended up winning because your opponents exited sooner. Okay? And then if we had more time, we would have shown a round three and a round four, but those have been preloaded. So at the end of the auction, you would see a My Results screen that's final. As you can see in this example, the bidder won in their third and fourth applications, whereas the bidder lost on their first two. And this screen also shows sort of the cash flows with respect to their deposits and their final payments. The last thing that I just want to show briefly is the messaging system. So this is how communication can occur most expeditiously with the auction manager. So there are two types of messages in the system. There's undirected messages to everybody in the auction, and then there are directed two-way conversations. So what's shown on this screen is an example of a one-way undirected message. We simply call those messages. That's the standard welcome message that you might see at the beginning of the auction. Now suppose you need support, then you might initiate a two-way conversation with the auction manager. It goes only to the auction manager. And so you type in your question, how will my bidding limit be affected by the tie-breaking round? And an answer is given here, and hopefully is given almost that promptly during the real auction. That's your demo. So maybe the only other thing I ought to say is if people have sort of detailed questions about how things work, I will be around through Wednesday, and I'm happy to answer people's questions that don't come up today.
Great, thanks, Larry. So I'm going to, first, before we get to the queue, I'm just going to reintroduce those topics for discussion, and we can go through them one by one if there is conversation about each one, have a little conversation after each slide, similar to the webinar, and then we'll open up for general Q&A at the end. So, the next one. Oh, sorry, two transition slides in there. Next one. So this is similar to what you saw in the webinar. So our current thinking on round duration is that the first round is 30 minutes, and there's a 10-minute recess between rounds, and round two and all subsequent rounds are 10 minutes. We've gotten some feedback, but I didn't want to change the proposals between the webinar and today. I didn't want to give the audience a moving target. So we have heard some feedback. We'll continue to listen to feedback here and for the next few weeks, I think. And then we'll finalize these decisions. So I think I've explained this before, so I'll turn it back to the queue. Do you have a topic on this topic? A question on this topic?
Sure. What is the formula for the upper limit of the rounds?
Roughly speaking, it will be set according to the perceived demand for that contention set. and is aimed so that the auction takes a reasonable number of rounds. I mean, bidders value getting the feedback as to how many other bidders are still in the auction, so you want it to go multiple rounds if possible, but at the same time it's really desirable to get the whole thing done in one day, and so according to indicators like how many applicants are in the contention set and maybe other external information about the overall level of demand, will set the end of round price. And then in all likelihood, it'll continue at the same rate in subsequent rounds.
Is it possible to publish an open formula?
Sorry, what are you looking for?
Is it possible to publish a formula as to how you're going to come up with this, or are you just intrinsically taking demand? Because if so, I'd like to see your demand data. Like, it's kind of arbitrary.
This has been how we've done it in other auctions, and it works very well. What we found is that following strict formulas leads to really strange things, like the auction ends instantly, or people are bidding for 30 rounds.
So you don't have a formula, you just pull the numbers out of your head.
That's what professors do.
Yeah, I have a whole series of very small questions that could probably be answered very quickly. First of all, with respect to the results of each one of the rounds, can I assume this is a silent auction? All you will be doing is announcing that there are only three bidders left at the end of each round. You won't announce who went out and at what number. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Secondly, you mentioned the fact that there are numerous redundancies available for entry into the auction. I'm assuming that most of these redundancies require a login sequence. So I would hate to have a situation where my laptop went down and I couldn't log in on a redundant deal. So will it be possible? Now, granted, we have two people who are authorized to bid, the gentleman over here and myself. But if my system went down, I would either be able to have multiple logins with my system for a backup so I don't run into it. Otherwise, the 10 minutes becomes a, do we really want 10 or maybe just a little bit longer? So
let me just give you a direct answer. The protocol that we use is that if you do a new login using the same username and password, it forces out the old one, which means that in particular, in that situation, you're on.
Yeah.
And the two authorized individuals get different usernames and passwords, so they don't log each other out.
Yeah. Secondly, a comment. I've done some research in your company, and you come with very, very high credentials. So I'm assuming during the auction process, correspondence between the individual bidders and a request for the chat sessions between you guys are very, very responsive on your part, so we don't have to wait any significant time if we post a question into your staff to get a response if it's the case.
We're experienced at giving a high level of bidder support during high-stakes auctions.
Fine. Thanks a lot. I have some additional questions that relate to the preparation for the auction, so I'm assuming you want me to save that until we get done talking about the process.
That would be great, Ken.
That's fine. Thanks.
Werner Stahl. Just my question is, why is the recess 10 minutes and not 2 weeks, specifically? You know, if people have been waiting for 8 years to blow an auction like that in a couple of minutes, we have what I call a transparency problem. And that is specifically the case because this auction is not supposed to be revenue maximizing. Revenue maximizing is the objective if you auction oil fields, if you auction, mostly, if you auction 3G spectrum and so on. You probably want to maximize revenue. This is not the case here. So why don't you allow people to go back during a recess, you know, talk with their constituents to see, you know, what they're going to do, and specifically, publish the result of each round, so actually the public can take the measure of what is going on.
So, as you know, the contention sets right now are public, and now is your opportunity to work with your constituents on establishing what your bidding limit will be for the contention set. Once we determine and notify the application that is going to be sent to auction, you have up to at least 60 days prior to the auction, prior to the bidding deposit being due. So we really are focused on using this time now to help applicants prepare for the auction. And as we've stated, the bidding deposit determines your maximum bidding limits. So that's kind of our rationale. And given that we have 200 contention sets to get through, need some way to move through them in an expeditious manner.
Well, I'm a little bit worried about that. So suddenly told, now we're in a hurry, even to actually say, we just want to rush people through the auctions when we have been waiting for other things all the time. And not looking into the externalities of the process here is something where actually, we may have a problem of failure by ICANN to, do what it's supposed to be doing. It's supposed to handle a process in the public interest.
I would just add that that's what the guidebook provided for, so those were the terms under which people applied.
John, do you have a comment on this topic? Okay. We'll move to the next topic. So the scheduling of auction events, I know this has been a question we get quite often. So our current thinking is the auction will be scheduled once a month or every 4 weeks or so initially. I did adjust the time after some discussion with Power Auctions from 1800 to 1600, but that's the only change to this slide. So auctions will be conducted at a standard time uniformly across all auctions, and deposits will be due the week before. Auctions will be at least 3 weeks after the notification date, so giving at least 2 weeks after notification of the actual date of the auction to provide a deposit, and still over 60 days after the original intent to auction notification. One area we're particularly looking for feedback is our current thinking is that a bidder will not be scheduled for more than 5 contention sets in a single auction event. What we've been talking about recently is giving the bidder the opportunity to waive that limit if they so choose, but we wouldn't force anyone to go beyond 5. And so we're looking for the community to help us understand, is that the right balance of number of auctions in an event for any particular bidder versus being able to move through these somewhat expeditiously. Any comments on this topic?
This is one of those situations where I'm not very sure where this question comes, so you can slap me down if it doesn't work right. Prior to the auction, will we have the information from the JAS report? Will we have some sort of an idea as to how many strings would be proposed to be blocked for this specific TLD before we bid on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the eligibility criteria was that the application would either have to be eligible for the alternate path, and that was published today, or if it wasn't eligible for the alternate path, we would wait until the full JAS collision occurrence assessment was provided so that applicants could do their proper analysis and valuations.
Okay, thanks. Go ahead, Paul.
Quick follow-up to that. Sorry, this is John Nevitt. Quick follow-up to that, though. The alternative path is just the first step, right? It might make sense to have the JAS report for all strings because, for example, I just looked at the list. We have one with over 100,000 strings that are being blocked. The JAS report mitigation measures could have a significant impact on valuation. You know, all we know is there's 100,000 strings that are blocked. We don't know what the mitigation path will be, so that might be helpful in determining that before the auction proceeds.
Thanks, John. We'll consider that. I think our current thinking was it was equal level of information, kind of like the stock market. Everyone has the publicly available information and can make their own valuation decisions. But I hear you. And
That might be true, but there are different models. So if you have maybe an open model versus a closed model, the impact could be greater to one applicant than another.
Sure. Thanks.
Two questions from the remote participants. The first one is from Christina Rosette. If a string that is in string contention is also one of the 25 strings that are ineligible for the alternative path to delegation, does the string's ineligibility for the alternative path to delegation have any impact on the timing of an auction of last resort?
Yeah, so I think that was what I just answered.
Okay. So. And the second question is from Brett Fawcett from Unit Registry. The rules are described as preliminary rules. Where can we submit comments to these? What is the process for turning the preliminary rules into final rules?
Thanks, Brett. So I think the appropriate feedback mechanism is the customer service center, so that all the comments are coming into ICANN and to my team. We'll probably publish. We can look at if we're going to publish that. My goal was to use discussion rather than the formal public comment process. So sessions like this to hear the feedback and see if there's consensus or non-consensus in the community. But we're open. The idea was to try and finalize the rules within the next couple of weeks, since they didn't differ very differently from the guidebook interpretations.
Can you put the timeline slide back up if we're talking timeline issues? Thank you. So I just wanted, this is John Nevitt again from Donuts. I want to make sure that we have a sufficient opportunity to your point about providing comments. And I don't care if it's a formal 42-day public comment period or a shorter period, but there's got to be a mechanism for those applicants who are participating in the auction to provide input. For example, you mentioned that you might change the time frame of the rounds. You got some input from someone. I'm not sure. I assume they want it longer, not necessarily shorter. But once you come up with a final proposal, I think you need to put that out for some kind of comment period. And the more important issue, and it's I think on a prior slide, you said there's a contract that will come to applicants to sign. If history is any guide on ICANN contracts, you know, we need an opportunity to be able to review them and negotiate those contracts as well. So we, you know, for timeline purposes, you might want to build in some window of opportunity to review and negotiate those contracts, as well as some kind of public comment period, however you deem to do that as well. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, our current line of thinking on the agreement was it was more like a user agreement, kind of like a software type user agreement. You've already entered into the agreement implicit in the guidebook of how contention will be resolved. So by you're essentially saying that you'll abide by the rules of the auction. But understood, heard it, and we'll take it into consideration.
Thanks, Russ.
Thanks, John.
Hi, I'm Gerardo Arizizabal from Primer Nivel. I was listening to your comments about the five strings per applicant per session, and it just doesn't seem like the right process to move forward. Because that would just like, the big applicants would be like mandating the pace of the whole process of the auction sets. So I just wanted to leave that comment because it would be just...
Sorry, what part of it?
So you're saying that it's five strings per applicant per auction, right? So if an applicant has 100 strings, then they would be like setting the pace for the whole process. And it just doesn't seem like the proper way to evenly take into account the interests of all other applicants.
Okay. Do you have an alternative recommendation?
I'll think about it and I'll...
Okay. We got another slide here. Postponement process. We've been asked about this quite a bit. So the current thinking on the postponement process is up to one postponement of up to 90 days may be granted per contention set. The request must be received, submitted by all applicants via their primary contacts through the customer portal. All members of the contention set submit their own request, and that request is due at the same time the bidder declaration of the designated bidder or the 30-day window for the after notification. The rationale for this is it prevents a single entity from stalling the auction process. The basis of requests for extension should be good faith attempts to resolve the contention set without an auction. So in order to have a good faith attempt, all parties need to be involved. And so that's our line of thinking on this one. I don't see any questions for this particular topic, so we'll just move on to general Q&A. So if there's any other items, please come to the mic. Thanks.
When I start again, I have made, you know, thought enough about all the implications that we have here, but there is one thing that is certain, that is the way that this has been designed is such that firepower is the most important thing, and it is about immediate firepower. It is but those who can raise as much as capital in an aggressive fashion, basically, you know, in a warlike fashion, to conquer something. Those are being favored by this process. And I don't think that is the right way of handling the DNS. It should have been about all kinds of influence that, you know, should be taken into account, including the ability, for instance, of community-oriented applicants to say, well, in case we see there is a lot of, you know, firepower being built up around us, that the community can actually raise its defenses. Many communities would be able to do that, you know, if they actually had the process of seeing things coming. But right now, basically, they're being told either you come up with something that typically a community applicant would not have. They don't have a war chest. Well, TLD investors do have a war chest. That's their business. So essentially, what we have here is a process that hands a large portion of the DNS to people whose business model is a war chest.
Thanks for the feedback, Warner. Okay, with that, we'll close the session. Thanks for your participation.